Friday, August 24th, 2001. In the Creekside room is Jan Keeson. Today's session number is KEJ2001-04, and it's titled How Public Like a Frog. Let's listen in.
Poems, because to know anything about Emily Dickinson, you have to read a lot about Emily. You know, you have to read a lot of Emily Dickinson, and you'll see that in a moment. She, I don't know how much you know, she was a recluse. A lot of people have stereotypical ideas of Emily Dickinson, that she, you know, was this recluse who lived up in this third floor bedroom in their house in Amherst and didn't socialize a whole lot and was very much withdrawn, quite a quaint person and so on and so on. Most of that is bunk. Most of that is bunk. It's people ride on those stereotypes and they make it, hey, come on in. Make it seem as though, I mean, you remember if somebody wears white a lot, you think, oh yeah, that, you know. And these gradually become stereotypes. But the fact of the matter is, just by the nature of her existence, she lived in Amherst. Her father was very active in the intellectual and theological world, so they had a lot of visitors that came to the house. In fact, the matter is, she didn't really have to travel far to be generating a lot of ideas. So she lived a very, even if she didn't travel far away, she lived a far more diverse and rich life than a lot of people think. Her father was a congressman, and she certainly lived, let's see, they have the Congress in Washington at the time. Was it Philadelphia? She traveled, does anybody?
That was before Washington, D.C. was going.
Yeah, before Washington, D.C., but I mean, there was a time in her life that she was exposed to, you know, some of the people, not only in the intellectual vanguard, but also political. When she was a student at Mount Holyoke, one of the revival movements that traveled through the eastern seaboard came through at that time, and she was asked, gives you an idea, everybody thinks she's such a spiritual person too, and she was, but they asked for people who, to in public, profess their faith in Christianity, and everybody in her class stood to do this except for Emily Dickinson. So I think it's really interesting, and I don't think it was because she did or didn't believe, it's just that she didn't probably like the procedure as well as one might think. But anyway, there's some interesting little facts about her that are just enough to make you question all the stereotypes that we've been introduced to.
Mm-hmm. Why is she hot right now?
Pardon?
Why is she hot right now? Mm-hmm.
Women's movement. Also, you can consider her a modern poet, a lot of people do, because she certainly wasn't discovered in the 19th century. Nobody read her then. She only had about 4 poems published in her whole life, and there were over 1,000 that she wrote. So that's one reason. Another reason centers on the fact that you know, this literature, since it came to its own, as late as the 50s even, when they started, they created this memorium where they actually put some numbers and sequences to these untitled poems that she had. She, you could find them after she died. They were in dresser drawers in what they call fascicles. And a fascicle, it's like 3 apostrophes in it, that word, was like something like this. And they were in these little packets that were bound with cord in her dresser drawer. And they discovered that after she died. People have fiddled around with her poetry. Some have tried to punctuate it, title it. But so you don't always know what the original version was. She sent her poems to an individual who was the editor of, not Harper's, what's the magazine?
Vanity Fair?
Pardon?
Vanity Fair?
No. It's just a mental glitch. I can't think of it right now.
Atlantic.
Atlantic. He wrote the most, Michael Higginson wrote the most beautiful response to another poet's writing. It wasn't hers, but it was somebody else's. And she read how carefully he had responded to that particular person's poetry. And so she wrote him and was hoping that maybe he would respond to her poetry too. And she asked in that letter if they breathed. Do they breathe? And I think it was her way of saying, did they come alive to you? When he read this, he knew right away that he was in the presence of these poems of something very, very different than any other kind of poetry he had ever read before. And secondly, it embarrassed him because he was the expert scholar. He had no idea how to categorize them, respond to them, and what to say. So to answer your question, Lori, in a lot of ways, she could be considered a modern poet. There's criticism that makes that argument that she's really a modern poet because of her technique and the way she...
What are her dates?
Oh, she lived to be 56 years old. Let's see, you know, 1800. I'm sorry, Julian, I forgot the specific dates. It would be like 1850, right around, not quite to 1900.
Okay?
Maybe a little before 1850. She was contemporary of Hawthorne, Paul Melville, Walt Whitman, whom she thought was over the edge. I've actually had exam questions at school where I ask, what if Whitman and Dickinson met each other? And you know, now tell me what happened. I like those kinds of questions because they can't study, you know, they have to study carefully, but they can't study for those kinds of answers. They have to think. I'm nobody. Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us? Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name the livelong day to an admiring bog. You know, if I were to ask you, I ask my students to ask me too, you want to be a nobody or you want to be a somebody? Right away, we all want to be somebody.
But don't you think that this was one of the poems that promoted the thought that she was a recluse? Because she says, I am nobody. She gives the inference here that she doesn't want to be out there.
Well, in this particular poem, she does. And we don't know specifically when it was written. This is kind of a guess, 1891. But the question, what I'm getting at is just in this economical short two-verse poem, how she can switch the meaning of words around. And these aren't words that you really have to look up in the dictionary, unless you're not like, you know, I look everything up in the dictionary. But she says, I'm nobody. And all of us, you know, want to be somebody. My students at Augustana College are in college because they want to be somebody someday. We all think we want to be somebody.
But we don't want to be Britney Spears. We want to be somebody interesting.
Right, right. But we, you know,
I mean, and that's, I think, what she's getting at.
Well, I think, I don't know. Let me get the rest of you to talk a little. I'm nobody. Who are you? Tell me your name again.
Karen.
Karen. Who are you? And you think, okay, you have an idea who you are. And then she says, are you nobody too? So the second line, right away, pitches us into a situation where maybe you're companions. And I think the implication is that you're companions in something where it's not like everybody else. I mean, it's almost like this is our secret. You know, I'm nobody, are you nobody too? There's paradise, there's no compass. And in case you're wondering about it, the next thing she says is, don't tell. They advertise.
And then you'd be somebody.
Pardon?
You'd be a somebody now.
Well, who is the they? You're nobody, and don't tell people or advertise. I think when you just first read that stanza, the implication, or at least if you pick up that, it would be so embarrassing if people found out that we were nobodies. This is our secret. Let's keep it that way. At least that's one way you can look at it.
Yeah. I also read that as even, you know, very much irony. But if you're nobody, and then they advertise, you're somebody.
Yeah.
You're the somebody who's...
It would destroy the being nobody.
Which in a way was her situation, if you think about her, you know, the hype about her.
Yeah.
Is that she was a recluse, but she was a very famous recluse.
But anyway, this whole notion of being nobody, what just fascinates me about this little poem, is that she almost buys into all these stereotypical interpretations. Nobody is to something, you know, we don't want to be nobody. Yeah. We want to, even if we're individuals and we're different than crowd and everything else, we still want to be somebody, you know. Even if we're an unusual somebody, we want to be somebody. I think, by the definition of the word, why are you shaking his head?
I feel on very well with Emily Dickinson. I would.
Okay.
He doesn't want to be a somebody.
No.
You don't want to be a somebody.
No, somebody's everybody. I don't want to be everybody.
Okay, well, see, you're jumping ahead. That's exactly what she gets to. Because in the next line, she says, how dreary to be somebody.
Yeah.
And it's kind of disarming because it undercuts everything, you know, convention would dictate to us. Here, Laura. It undercuts whatever we would typically attribute to what's normal, or crowd pleasers, or what's ordinary. But she says how dreary to be somebody. What does dreary mean?
Boring.
Pardon?
Boring.
Boring?
Really dark headache.
Really dark headache?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Heavy.
Set.
Kind heavy.
Depressive.
Pardon?
Tiring.
Tiring, right. Tedious, maybe?
And boring and all.
Boring? How dreary to be. And I think also with not many prospects, you know, how dreary to be somebody.
Only bright on the horizon.
Yeah. And then if you don't get that, she says in the next line, how public like a frog. Now, if I were to ask you to give me an analogy for something public, you say, oh, frog, would we?
No, not hardly.
I don't think any of us would say that, ever. I mean, we'd sit here for days and wouldn't think of frog. But what's the point? You know, how public like a frog? All right, so if you look at a frog, what do they do?
They croak.
What do they say?
Ribbit.
All right, let's all say it together.
Ribbit.
Ribbit. Ribbit. Really, this is really innovative.
But look at the audience that frog has. The dog.
All right. So what's this frog? So anyway, you think of a frog. I don't know how many frogs are around here. You know, maybe you go to a little wetter area to see them. But they are kind of public. They're kind of splatted about there. I hope there's no frog lovers here, Kermit or whatever. But I mean, they just
hear them for miles.
Pardon?
You can hear them for miles.
Yeah, you can hear them for miles. They're just out there. And they do seem to be quite public, as you know, the way they are. But how public, like a frog, she says. And then if you don't, to tell one's name, and it goes ribbit, to tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring bog. So I can't help but think of homecoming queens or something like that, you know. Somebody in Glamour magazine, and you know, when you get as old as I, your chances for ever achieving anything like this are rapidly fading. Or what I love to use this poem when my students at Augie are doing the one thing I dislike the most about what students at Augustana College do, and that is pledging.
Oh,
and
right.
In the springtime,
oh.
When they're involved in this, they do not want to be nobody.
You make them read this poem?
You bet I do. And so, you know, I just can't resist it. Well, you know, it's like how public, like a frog, or like all those people who are out there running around pledging. They laugh, and others don't think it's right. Terribly funny, especially if they've been up all night doing it.
Right.
But anyway, the nobodies very quickly become somebody. And as somebody, very quickly becomes common, something undesirable, something that you don't want to do. So what's interesting about what she does is the wordplay. Very quickly, what we would attribute to something important turns around to not be important at all, to be common. So if I were to ask you, so why don't you write a poem that ridicules people who think they're somebody. And you have like two, you can only do this in two short stanzas.
Yeah.
And could any of us begin to do this? I mean, if you start to think of the dynamics that's at work here, and in the workplace, you could realize a little bit about, you know, the genius of Emily Dickinson, that she can pull this off. And in language, it's disarming too, because it's in language that, we have ordinary ideas about what nobodies and somebodies are, and she manages to change us around. How does she do this? What's the rhetorical device? How is she able to turn our ideas around?
Usually, if you're saying the opposite of what you mean, it's an irony.
All right, so it's irony. And like, you know, where I live, they have billboards that say, you want to drink while you're driving? The Illinois police will show you the bars. And they have pictures of jail bars. But the fun, the irony is that, yeah, you want to drink and drive? We'll show you the bars. Here, irony is precisely what I was hoping somebody would say. It's ironic when, you know, you assume when you're buying into this poem at first, you're assuming that nobodies are your stereotypical nobodies, and somebodies is also stereotypical. But she turns it around by saying how dreary, and then this analogy to frog.
Well, I think the other thing that anyone who lives by the lake, you hear the frogs all the time, but you do not see them. Rarely do you see frogs. You'll see toads, but rarely do you see frogs. And very little itty-bitty things. They have these huge voices.
Yeah.
And people hear them.
Okay, I see where you're going with that. Because I see frogs every morning when I'm walking, you know, where I live.
But you hear their voices throughout the whole bog. And it says to tell one's name and live long. The only thing they know is what those people are saying. They don't know the people.
Right. Okay. Okay.
You can tell I looked at this poem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm glad. It always makes, I mean, I make my students write response papers every day before.
So I like the word advertise here, too.
Yeah, don't you know?
It just kind of stands out, and it brings in the modern world and all the machinery of publicity.
So again, you know, it makes it seem like a modern poem, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, immediately conjures the Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame.
Right, right, right.
How can it be very important if everybody's doing it, sort of thing?
Yeah.
And yet this is 100 years before.
Yeah, that's...
It is interesting.
I wonder, too, though, about her privilege. You know, that she, in a sense, she came from a world of somebodies, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not so sure it was that privileged, but... She did. She had interesting history. People were doing interesting things. Having a father who was a congressman and one of the leaders in theology in that area.
Not that I know.
And knocking it around with other people like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So are you saying, you know, she doesn't want to just be the frog in the bog. She wants to be the... You know, the egret on the river or something.
Okay, better than the frog in the pool. Yeah, they're good.
I never thought about that. Well, maybe she sees all the somebody's croaking around her and she's not very impressed.
Yeah.
But I mean, now to ask you again, are you nobody or somebody? Depends, you know, Dickinson. I think all of us would rather be.
The interesting thing about her nobody, though, is that her nobody immediately comes into relationship with another nobody.
Yeah, that.
So there's intimacy there, and you know that implies being seen and having all that that implies.
And it's not that we're just a waste. There's nobody there.
That is somebody to another nobody.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, in a more important way.
But there is a community there, and this notion of being a recluse is.
Yeah,
it's almost contradicted in his poem here.
Right.
Excellent point. Let's move on. I only have three for today, and I'm going to let you go. But I just wanted you to see the range. I chose this one on page 98, 214, because you were coming here to Holden, and I thought that because nature is so beautiful here, you might get a bang out of this poem. But the first one is ironic, and it seems as though far as to say she seemed resentful in the first poem, but she certainly distances herself from who's common, the common crowd. Here, she's just delighted with nature. And it's just this playful, wonderful poem. I get such a bang out of reading it. A taste of liquor never brewed from tankard scooped in pearl. Not all the vats upon the Rhine yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew. Really, through endless summer days, from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats, and saints to windows run, to see the little tippler leaning against the sun.
Well,
let's go down here. There's a lot of wordplay in here. What's your basic gut reaction? I mean, you don't have to think real deeply right away. What's happening on just a basic manifest level? She says, I taste the liquor never brewed. All right, what's liquor? If you're like me by now, as much as I like Golden Village, I could do with a nice glass of wine with something tonight, huh? But she says, I taste a liquor never brewed. All right, so it's something that's
more natural.
Not fermented, from tankard scooped in pearl. So now, whether it's never brewed from tankard scooped in pearl, but there seems to be a dash here. So from tankard scooped in pearl. So pearl comes from where? We have somebody who knows a little bit about marine biology here. Where are pearls?
Dewdrops and stuff.
Oysters.
Dewdrops.
Okay, it could be dewdrops. Could be what else?
Rain or drizzle or something.
Okay. All right, so we're not going to go the pearl route, you know, in anything in the marine world. All right, so it's tankard, but it's scooped in pearl. So you have a scooper here. What are you going to do that way?
With a scoop?
Yeah, how are you going to make the scooper out of pearl? What is it?
Could be an oyster shell.
Mm-hmm. Okay, chewing. An oyster shell with a pearl. Okay. Or it could be just like a good sized flower that's pearly looking and she's drinking the dew does she really have to be tasting it literally?
No.
Maybe not. Not all the vats upon the Rhine. Where is this? What's this referred to?
The Rhine Valley.
Yeah, these great big tons of things. And has Dickinson ever been there?
No,
but she knew about it. Not all the vats upon the Rhine yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of air am I. What does it mean when you're inebriated?
Drunk.
But
air.
Don't you feel that way when you go out for a hike here and you look at the mountains, you look at this valley? I mean, you think, whoa! Huh? And I think that's what she's describing. So this is a Holden Village poem. Emily Dickinson, Holden Village. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew. What was a debauchee? What are they?
Carousers.
So I mean, she's getting kind of mischievous here, playing around. Emily Dickinson is getting a little daring with the language. I'm debauchee of dew. What do you make of that?
Alliteration.
Pardon?
That is. Alliteration.
All right, alliteration. There's a lot of D sounds. But debauchee of dew. She's debauched the dew. What do you think of that? Laura?
Well, like she's been rolling in the fresh dew of a meadow or something, and yeah.
Right, getting green sleeves, huh?
Yeah, and acting.
Sure, those women got their green sleeves from rolling around in the meadow. I know, I looked it up. Reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. What's the inn? When landlords, and she has that in quotes, beekeepers, or whoever's in charge of this creation, turned a drunken bee. What is this bee drunken?
No, nectar.
Yeah, he's drunken, endangered. Yeah. A drunken bee out of the foxglove's door. You know what foxgloves are, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when butterflies renounce their drams, what is drams? Okay. I shall but drink the more. All right. Till seraphs, and then these are angels, swing their snowy hats. And again, I'm sure we took a walk down the trail today. We could see some of these. Seraphs swing their snowy hats, and saints to windows run to see the little tippler. What's a tippler? Pardon?
It's like a little glass.
All right, it's a little glass, but a tippler.
A person. It's someone who drinks.
It's a person who drinks.
Right.
And she's a little tippler, leaning against the sun. All right, so on one level, she could be, you know, out in the sunshine, just relishing nature. But are there any puns or double meanings in this poem, possibly? Would we be reading too much into it to say that? What do you think? Leaning against the sun. Yeah, I think so. Let's pursue that a little bit. So it would be sun. Who would be the sun then?
She's using the homonym.
I think that one way you could read it, and the trick to the answer to whether you're reading something in a poem, whether it is or not, is if you could see consistent analogies to those ideas. But all right, is there a theological end to this poem? For me, I'm happy reading it just, you know, with nature, and that's why I brought it up here, even though we'd be in a beautiful area. But there are some folks that like to read it and say she's thanking God for all of creation, just rejoicing in this and resting what her faith or her happiness on the sun, you know, the fact that her Savior has taken care of her too. I don't think that's an unreasonable way of looking at this poem.
Well, in the same stanza, she also uses the word saints.
Well, you
say
saints
and seraphs.
So you
could justify it, I suppose.
Yeah. And landlords, you know, you could certainly have, you know, that God is watching his creation. It starts out with, you know, liquor and tankards, and the word debauchy is just a little disturbing if you're going to look for a Christian interpretation. Well, it might be, unless
this is going, I mean, maybe this is going the other way, and so it's nature as opposed to a Christian.
And that is another excellent way. Keep talking.
Because I mean, here are these saints, I mean, aren't they a little bit shocked to see this?
This is good. Oh, I love this.
I don't know.
Tell me your name one more time.
David,
keep talking.
I think I ran out of things to say.
Well, can anybody help him out with that idea?
Well, what I'm thinking is that, you know, up until the last stanza, she's going to keep drinking and keep reveling in this creation and the drunkenness of it till the seraphs, swing their snowy hats. And so it's almost as if then...
Is she stopping then or not?
Yeah, but drink the more till...
Does she almost sound like she does, you know, I'm getting damp, I'm going to do what I want here?
Yeah.
Until winter.
Pardon?
Until winter, or until, I guess, she gets older. Or until...
Clouds? That's what's fun about this, you know, there's no one right answer. What do you think the snowy hats are? Anybody?
I would be wondering.
Winter?
Well, if you, and I don't know if these are in order, but they feel like flowers to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Same way with the term tippler.
Well, see, if...
A flower, you think a tippler is a flower?
Sure.
Well, and
flowers lean and tip toward the sun.
To see the little tippler leaning against the sun.
That could be
I see what you're saying. I never thought of that.
To windows run. I mean, this is a godly scene. To see the little tippler leaning against the sun, which is...
Okay.
Well, look at us. A branch plant to look at is a sunflower, because he was just trimmed with a sunflower.
Yeah, okay.
But see, these little plants go outside in the morning, I just don't want to do.
When they first start opening, especially ones that close at night and open again during the day, the first thing they aim for is the sun.
Okay.
Toward the sun.
All right. So what do you do with day watching? Well, it's okay. I think the Devachi of dew is that thing when you go out and the whole field is covered with dew and you go running through it and you break the dew and you make a pathway and all of a sudden the glistening is gone.
Oh, I see.
That is an interesting idea. Because think about it, if you go out in a hay meadow or a field that's not mowed, and you're out in the very early part of the morning, and the dew sits on the top of the grass, but as soon as you move through it, you break the dew.
Okay, so you're violating in some ways the notion of something being debauched.
Yeah. That's what I think she's talking about. But I don't know, it's kind of a literal.
Devachi, though, means someone who is debauched, not someone who does.
And I think debauch is better. So I see her as the debauchee. I see her as Dionysian, as giving herself over to nature. And that the last paragraph is actually tells Sarah Swing that the till is important, that she can have this ecstasy until Sarah Swing or snowy hats and sinks to windows run to see the little tippler. If she's the little tippler leaning against the sun, and she's being observed, you know, by judges, by people who aren't.
These people looking through the windows, right?
Yeah.
Nothing else, right?
Is she maybe converting them also?
Well, I don't know if you...
What do you think?
Well, it might be historical. I mean, if it's Dionysian, and then, you know, and then we think about the assertion of Christianity.
Okay, we have an expert here on myths and things. He knows stuff I don't know. And talk to us a little bit more about this.
Well, it really isn't. I mean, I'm overreading the poem at this point.
No, but I mean, it's just so fabulously interesting anyway, so just talk about it, even if it doesn't relate to the poem.
Okay. But
I love hearing these stories.
The whole first part of this poem is so ecstatic.
It is. I mean, that was my question, the tone of this.
And it's ecstatic, and it's an evocation of alcohol and grapes, and you can't read this without thinking of Dionysus, who would drink and turn into ecstasy and get the maenads, and they would dance all night, and as opposed to Apollo. I mean, Dionysus was always opposed to Apollo, which was light and clarity and logic.
Now, wasn't Dionysus a she?
No.
And wasn't Apollo a he? No.
No, Dionysus was a he.
But was he more of a sensual, more of a hedonist?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And often depicted as sexually ambiguous.
Okay.
But certainly sexually profligate. I mean, all of the verdant. You know, there's an enormous amount of sexuality and passion and mindlessness. I mean, just...
But all of this is kind of innocent because she, you know, this alcohol is only due and, you know...
No, she's very careful to say that, but there's no way... This is even better.
My reaction would be that, but isn't she playing around with the language a little bit? I mean, aren't there some implications that this is at least a little bit sexy?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
You know? But yeah, this,
and there doesn't seem to me to be much difference between her, whoever the, you know.
Do we know it's a she?
Well,
does
we
she
don't
say
know.
She?
We're assuming,
yeah.
But her and nature. I mean, it's like the whole creation of the celebration.
Yeah. Leaning against could also be a big hug. You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I think of it just kind of. When she's a tippler, why do I think of it that she's leaning that way?
But it could be.
I never thought of it this way.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it I don't know technically, but isn't a tippler a glass with a round bottom?
Oh, I don't know that.
There's a dictionary in the next room.
I mean, like a
keep talking, I'll look it up.
What? Like a brand
new one?
Yeah, but with a completely round bottom. I think that's what the...
Oh, really?
Then it's a thing that isn't completely flat on the bottom, and I maybe have this wrong, but I think that a tippler is the thing that wobbles back and forth.
I
think that's where the word tipple as a drunk comes from, is it's a glass with a round bottom, and so that when you set it down, it kind of flipples around before, it doesn't fall over, but it's not thud down, but it wobbles and moves.
Well, if you're, you know, if you take a tall, long glass with a small bottom, and you tittle that a little bit, you know, it'll
spin
just about fall over, you know, and still come back out. So, I think he's getting drunk on his feet, but still on his feet.
It's a big picture.
Tell us your name again and sit down. Mona. Boy, if that isn't a good name for what we're talking about. Here,
we're talking about Emily Dickinson. And we're actually talking about inebriation and running field review.
Okay. Tippler.
A person who tipples intoxicating liquor. Second definition, person who works at a tipple, especially a mine. Now isn't that fitting for holding? We're right by mine. Okay, but tipple, folks, verb form, I'm looking where it comes from, medieval English. To drink intoxicating liquor, especially habitually, or to some excess. I think it's kind of a delicate word. That's the way I've always read it. A delicate way of saying, oh, he's a tippler, or she's a tippler, rather than say this guy's a drunk. It's really meaning that he is.
Right.
But I mean, a delicate way of saying he's a tippler.
Is there a noun for him?
Okay. But I'm still seeing if there's this goblet, because that would be interesting. To drink intoxicating liquor, especially repeatedly in small quantities. All right, so that's the next definition. The third one is intoxicating liquor, and that's in 1400s, 1500s. From the medieval tippler, tapster. Okay, we could have taps in anybody.
Which would be the one that is serving the liquor?
Yeah, tapster. So I just have to look, you know, I do a history in words too, so you'll have to pardon me. Just for a moment here.
Just doing one of my favorite things. I tab dictionary aloud.
No blocks to it, is there?
No, but boy, is it fun. You can spend all afternoon reading the dictionary aloud.
But this dictionary doesn't have your idea of a glass, but it makes perfect
but
sense.
But think about glass blowing in the medieval period. It wasn't like they had... I mean, would have all been hand-blown. There weren't milled, you know.
Yeah, right. So that seems to me a real possibility. And this is not the OED. This is Random House.
But I think that word, when you use it, simply, if you take a person standing up, or a narrow glass standing upright, right, and you push that a little bit, it tipples around and diddles around before it maybe finally crashes, or comes back up. If you take a drunken bush, what does he do? He tipples.
Yeah, tipples and tips.
All directions.
I mean, those words are all connected. Now we have tap here. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's lots of stuff on tap. To strike. Stick. I won't read you all this, but a tap house, a tap room, a tool. Let's see what's... Okay. To draw the tap or plug yourself. All right. But anyway, so much for that for now. See, I have all my notes at home, and I'm working at a disadvantage here. Because I couldn't carry them all here on the plane.
What's the story about her seemingly odd use of capitalization?
Your guess is as good as mine, Jeff, and any of the critics, they don't know. It was just an idiosyncratic way. A lot of people think it was something that she wanted to emphasize, But if you read some of the poems, that doesn't necessarily make sense either, because there's other things that seem to, you know, some poems obviously turn on certain words that aren't capitalized. So it's just a mystery. Maybe she did it for decoration, maybe whimsical, who knows? But what impresses me the most is just the genius of the language, the economy, the irony that's at work. You know, we've been sitting here for 15, 20 minutes, and I don't think there's anybody who's uninformed or ignorant in this class. We all have very different ideas as to how to look at this, and they're all good ideas. So it just goes to show you that, you know, there's nothing simple about Emily Dickinson, even if the words are relatively simple. You ready to move on to another one, or you still want to play around with this one? You're ready to move on? Lori says this one?
No, I said move.
Oh, move. Okay. I hate to end. I thought about this because this last one is so grim, and I think it's one of her finest poems. But I'll read this to you. And the reason I chose this is because it is one, in my opinion anyway, one of the finest poems that she's written, and also it gives you an idea of the range. At first, you know, we had this ironic poem, now we have this tippler one. We're playing around with. Wait till you hear this. This is 280, you know, number 280 on page 128. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift the box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll as all the heaven wore a bell and being but an ear. And I in silence, some strange race wrecked solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing, how do I end? Then, or, and finished knowing then, which is how I prefer to read.
Well, there's a dash afterwards, you can expect something to be.
So, has anybody felt a funeral in his brain?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's it like? You want to talk about that?
Well, it seems to me what she's talking about is, a malaise or a depression. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing that lingers in the back of your head that it's going to be over or something. And I love that idea, the mourners to and fro, the idea of that thing when you're like up in the middle of the night and something just keeps going back and forth and back and forth across your brain, the thing that you don't have any control over, that you can't stop, you know, it's like running, mourners going back and forth. And until it seemed that sense was breaking through, like maybe she was going to have some sort of a realization, but then she doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very poignant call.
And then... Okay, but you felt the funeral in your brain as though something were ending. Mm-hmm. Funerals for something died. So would you go so far as to say she just felt that anything that she sensed, you know, in her brain was about to die? But most of us, if we feel something like that, if you're like me anyway, you just think you're going to die. But then she has this whole scenario, these mourners to and fro. To and fro, kept treading, treading. So who are the mourners? Who in the world is in your brain doing that?
I think it's like, it could be like parts of yourself, like the things that you hold on to when things are changing, and sometimes you don't want to let go of, you know, the things that are changing. And then, you know, then it says, you know, like you just keep going over it and over and over it, and it's a thin space. I mean, and then, but then at the end when she says, and finish knowing, I mean, it's like you do or hopefully you do at some point move on. You most likely have to let go of this stuff and
right.
just move
but
on.
But is this happening?
And that there is something else.
Yeah, that's what we would hope, but is this happening in this poem?
That's what makes
you know, the way I read it is the funeral is, you know, like a depression that's so heavy that there's no movement or life.
There's no what?
There's no movement or life. There, right. You know, it's that kind of really numb kind of depression. But the mourners actually begin to wake her up. So the feeling
it's
of
be more of a positive.
The feeling of grief or the sadness for herself, that the kind of feeling for herself, you know, brings the possibility of sense coming through the reason.
Okay, so kept
there
ready.
There's a lot of female image here. Because
mm-hmm.
there's the mourners, there's the service, the drum.
Yes.
The bell.
There's the box.
Yeah, they, so
the
bells.
There's all of that is a funeral service, right?
It's really morbid, isn't it? Yeah. So those same boots lived in space began to toll. All right, so we're leaping ahead, but first of all...
Incredible.
Pardon?
That is an incredible image. Then space began to toll.
Isn't it?
Just all by itself. It's like, it's about as good as it gets when you think about how evocative that is. I mean, so everything's dead. Everybody's in their place, you know, and there's been this drumbeat. And then space began to toll.
So how would space toll?
Well, it's the resonance of the universe itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
right. It's not just, I mean, it's a grand tragedy on the biggest scale. It's not one person.
I also hear that as a call to life. Right? Mm-hmm. All the heavens were a bell and beam, but in your ear is what receives all of that.
Yeah.
But then she is
so like,
solitary.
It's like high
and
silence.
Yeah.
Tell the words.
All of that.
Yeah, I hear.
What do you think?
I think you're right.
I think it's her.
It's like she keeps calling forth this possibility of life and finding that, you know, she can't respond.
And see, your reading makes it even more horrible. Because, you know, it seems like what you're seeing is maybe flickers of that she still might be conscious and then she realizes.
I think that's what happens. And I think that's what the end.
The tragedy, the drama, the dimension of the tragedy.
I think that's the end, too.
So anyway, an eye and being, I mean, in other words, existing, but in the ear. So it's something, when you exist... You at least are sensitive enough. I mean, you're sentient enough to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in silence, imagine that companion. I, in silence, some strange race, rest solitary here.
Yeah.
So, very disquieting, Paul.
Yeah.
I like that idea, though, that you are in companionship with silence, and yet you're sort of. I mean. She's there.
Yeah.
Well, because strangely evocative of I'm nobody or you nobody too. There's two of us, right? So there's two nobodies. I and silence are in relationship with each other. They're identified, but horribly here identified as outside of the universe,
mm-hmm.
outside of the action of life itself.
But it gets worse.
I know.
It gets worse. And then a plank in reason woke. So whatever you stand on for stability,
mm-hmm.
and metaphorically, it breaks.
Right.
And I dropped
right.
down.
I think you're right. I think that happens at each one. Each one, it's all the time.
Okay. I agree. It's scary. And so I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge, and finish knowing, and a lot of people want to read, and finish knowing then.
Then, it's like out there. Then, you're waiting, and she leaves you in the...
So, so it could be an imaginative examination of suicide.
It could be.
See,
I think we most of us agree this is a poem about death. But what we might want to ask is a death of what?
Well, see, I don't think she's I don't think she's allowing herself the solace of, you know, of what, of sort of the romantic notion of death, that I'm in a...
Oh, no!
Not at all. I mean, that there's still going to be another hope or another level of suffering or another...
I don't think so. Now, you know, in other poems, you know, she's this little dove cooing on the Heavenly Father's breast.
Right.
And so there she's just very happy with her faith. And there are other poems of absolute despair where she rejects her faith. So in order to know something about Emily Dickinson, you have to read a lot of Emily Dickinson. And finish knowing then. So if, let's just go back a little bit. And then a plank of reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then.
And start over at the beginning.
Well, it's outside of reason.
All right, so it's outside of reason, outside of hearing, outside of the world. For me, at least, this poem seems like the disintegration of a mind. And that...
I was going to say overwhelming. Because, I mean, the world and then going down in another world and going down in another... And then, I mean, like, how much could you take? Like, it's just overwhelming. Yeah.
Here's how it takes things away. It starts with I felt, and then it says, and it seemed as if sense was breaking through, but then the next stanza ends, my mind was going numb, which means it does not feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one starts, I heard, and you get these sounds, but then the next stanza ends with complete silence, where nothing can be heard.
Yeah.
It's only she and silence, and there is no sound, right?
So if we were to write these things on the board, let's try to make some sense out of what you're saying. So first of all, David, you're saying I felt, it begins with feeling, I felt.
It begins with feeling, yeah.
Okay, and then how does it end? And it's how that sense.
Well, it ends with finished knowing.
Thank all right, you. Sense was breaking through.
Yeah. My mind was going numb.
Okay, and as you said, my mind was going, let's see, my sense.
So I'm pairing felt and my mind was going numb, and then I'm pairing heard and silence and rec solitaire.
So, okay, heard.
So what I'm saying is there's an action in the poem that takes away the faculties of the mind.
Okay. And what you're saying is the author is very deliberate about showing us that this is at work.
An erasure, yeah.
Okay, good. Can you think of any others?
Well, then you've got the last verb, or the last stanza, the last verb.
Well, then I don't know.
Well, you got reason and
finish
now. So she takes reason away.
But there's still that then.
Well,
I don't think it's totally grand. If you look at this like it's a depression, actually the first time I read this I thought it was a migraine headache.
You know, I have thought that too, with the dreading and
it's just like a migraine headache.
Yeah.
And it's also just like a depression, and then you get down, it can't possibly be worse. But there's this, you know, and you're hitting worlds. I mean, you're smashing worlds. And you're not knowing, you're done knowing everything, and then it doesn't end.
I agree.
I think
this poem does not end, or in terms of form and meaning, the ending drops out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Rather than and finish knowing then.
Right.
See,
right.
And finish knowing then.
And I'm not sure that's hopeful.
I'm not either.
I mean, I think it's ambiguous. Yeah. And I think it's intentional.
Yeah. Well, in a terrible depression, the then would not be hopeful because it just means the storm is going to go on
and on.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. This also reminds me like of the dark night of the soul kind of experience.
Yeah.
Where the thing you're standing on keeps falling away.
Yeah.
The thing you think is solid, you know, isn't.
But also having been down there before, you come back up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of whether you want to or not.
Where do you see words you're going to come back up again?
You just do.
In a poem or
oh no, in life.
She's putting
stay alive. I think some people come back up and some don't. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are people who dropped out.
That's true.
That didn't come back.
But they didn't, their lives didn't end. I mean, I guess.
Well, some did.
Well, or some people killed themselves. But what she seems to be saying is, you're way down there and you finish knowing, and then. So in other words, it does go on somehow. And either you go up or you keep living down at the bottom. But it's not, I mean, unless you end it yourself, which at this point, you really aren't capable of that kind of action. You have no choice. It continues, and you go up or down or whatever, but you don't have any choice, I think.
Okay. So in other words, the experience is kind of running away with the writer, that mm-hmm. the experience is taking over when she is incapable of writing about anything. But mm-hmm. but the
yeah,
action...
I think the end, sort of, I mean, there's nothing after the end, because how could you make a poem without reason? Mm-hmm. Or hearing, or
right, it's like those kinds of stuff.
Feeling.
Right, ask Laura.
What?
What?
Say it again.
I'm saying, there's nothing after this final then, because mm-hmm. there's no way to make a poem, because she's taken away reason, she's taken away a hearing, and she's taken away feeling. But, you know, if all of those are gone, then how could there be a poem?
Right. I think that's true, and you can get to a point where you don't have any of those things. You still exist, though.
You see, that's probably what would be more horrible than if you didn't exist.
At the moment, probably is more horrible. I mean, maybe I'm in an optimistic
phase. Well, okay. I say we can use a little optimism with this poem. It is just so,
part
so
of it
despairing.
Is, she just feels like she's reached the end.
Yeah, I think so.
And I've felt like I've reached the end before, and it hasn't been the end.
Uh-huh.
And worse things happen, and you discover you could still keep right on going.
Yeah.
So it's kind of... I think that's what part of it is, because she's still around writing this, right?
Didn't she have health problems? She wasn't that healthy.
She died of kidney disease at what, the age of 59, if I remember correctly.
Well, so I don't know whether
she was had chronic, serious yeah. problems all the time.
Yes, but I can't remember. But she was sickly, that's the term where she was dead.
Yeah.
I think it's mental,
okay.
Not necessarily.
Was there evidence that she had mental, like depression and things like that?
I don't think there's any evidence other than, you know, what people make out of the poems.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, she's a genius, and she's supposed to be different and unconventional and write about things that the rest of us wouldn't think of. You know, how public like a frog. Or I heard a fly buzz when I died. How about that one? I don't know if I had that one crafted or not. You want to end on a lighter note. Let's see if I had it once. Well, I can tell you a little bit about it. You'll probably catch on a lot quicker than my students will. No, I don't see it here. Okay, maybe I remember part of it, but not all of it. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The mourners, I'm almost getting mixed up. But anyway, they had from their eyes dry, and she was waiting to meet the king, and then there was, there interposed a blue, something was stumbling up. I'm doing it so bad.
I've got it.
Oh, do we have to know it? Oh, I think they can say that. Certain stumbling buzz. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness round my form. Oh, this is different. The version I know is the stillness in the room, but I'll read this. The stillness round my form was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes beside it wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering shore for the last onset. When the king be witnessed in his power, I will my keepsake signed away what portion of me could make assignable. And then there interposed the fly with blue uncertain stumbling buzz
between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see. So what's this about? What does it seem to be about?
It seems to be about the moment in which you realize you're dying.
All right, all right. Yeah. So she says, how many of us would say, oh, I heard a fly buzz when I died? I mean, you know, we're talking about an author that's ready. I mean, Laura was making the argument that she might indeed be, you know, the action of the poem might be beyond her. I mean, she's beyond writing right now, but still things are going, because then indicates that something else might well happen. All right, so here she says, I'm getting at the genius of Dickinson and the unconventional idiosyncratic ideas that she has. But I heard a fly buzz when I died. I didn't make it.
Well, I was in a really terrible accident in December, and I distinctly remember, even though I broke my leg in 17 places, dislocated my foot from my leg, and tore all the tendons to my toes, I distinctly remember this specific sound when I was laying on my patio trying to figure out how to move from where I fell to the phone. And the thing that stuck in my head was like the fly. It was the coffee dripping in the percolator in the kitchen, which was about 400 yards from where I was. It was the only thing I could hear. And I remember when I got to the hospital, the doctor asked me, well, what was I thinking about? And I was completely fixated on the fact that I couldn't turn off the coffee pot where I left in the ambulance. And there's a thing that happens to you, which she gets to in that poem, I think, which is that some really major thing can be going on, and your brain gets attached to some weird detail.
Okay.
And it happens over and over again.
Yeah.
These things that you...
Yeah.
And...
All right, so you hear this fly buzz when you're when I die. Okay, good.
You do.
So, but you didn't die.
No, I came very close to it.
Jeez. Because you probably died of pain.
Hypothermia, actually. But it's, I mean, it was...
Well, now we're all curious. You have to tell us the rest of the story.
How did that happen?
I was filling my bird feeder, and I was walking across my yard, and I stepped off of a snowdrift onto what I thought was a sidewalk with an inch of snow on it, but my gutters had overflowed the day before, and it was solid ice under about 3/4 of an inch of snow, and I stepped down on my toe, and I twisted my leg really, really badly. And then I was home alone, so I couldn't get to the telephone, so I had to pull myself through the snow. Anyway, I nearly died, but... which was kind of neither here nor there in relationship to
myself. Well, yeah,
it is. But there is something about that when, you know, I mean, I should have been way more concerned. But I think it's something your brain does. It's like, you know, you can't deal with what you're going through, so your brain fixates on some stupid little thing that's over here that holds you in some sort of abeyance.
I think you're right.
I also think, I think that that's really true. I think Dickinson is taking something that everybody thinks is this terribly big event, this, and making it ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And because death is like this thing we all stand sort of mobilizing, falling on the ground, and it's just like...
Let's get to what's ordinary. I want to leave you laughing rather than go finish knowing that. Have you all walk out here cringing.
The fly is
awake. Yes. I heard a fly buzz when I died. All right, let's just assume that she did die. Just stay with me on this, okay? She wasn't lucky. The stillness round, it's supposed to be the stillness in the room. I don't know. It's collected poems. Okay, but anyway, I'll read it this way. The stillness round my form was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes beside had wrung them dry. You know, so she thought she died. The eyes had wrung them dry. Who are these people?
Mourners.
Yeah, mourners. Had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering sure for the last onset when the king be witnessed in his power. Who's the king?
God.
It would be Jesus, that she's waiting to come down and take her soul up. I will my keepsake signed away what portion of me be assignable. All right, so everybody's got everything. It's all lined up. They're done mourning.
Then there interposed a fly with blue uncertain stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed and I could not see. So what's this fly? So she's, let's just assume she's dead, right?
Well, so one thing that people hear a lot when they're either going out or passing out or they have a near-death sort of experience, they hear a buzz. It's real common.
Interesting. See, I didn't know that.
Hear what?
And they reach
here. They hear a buzz.
Okay, they reach hand the light.
We talked about the light being here and then it was gone. Okay. It's gone.
All right, so this could very well be, you know, an accurate account of, you think this is what she's writing about, though? I died and I just heard this buzz.
She's very matter-of-fact about it.
Why did she put a fly in there?
See, I think the fly brings us back to the sort of animal nature of the whole experience.
Okay, you know, so, let's keep talking about this.
So
what
there's
would be
the king and
all right, so the king would be God, and everything's supposed to be wonderful, and she willed all her keepsakes away. What's correct. The tone of this poem, by the way? And then there interposes this fly with blue uncertain stumbling buzz. So, I mean, she's dead. What time of the year is it?
Summer.
It has to be, because what?
There's flies.
And it's New England. She lives in New England, so there's flies. So it's got to be summertime. She's in what state?
Dead.
So we have a marine biologist here who might be able to tell us what would happen if you have a corpse in New England in the summertime and it's been laid out for a week for all the relatives to come. And everything's been done. She's wheeled her keepsakes away. The mourners have run their eyes dry. They're waiting for the king to come into the room. And what happens?
Maggots. Sorry.
Exactly. At least that's the way I read this.
Yeah, it's funny.
I think it's hilarious.
It is.
It's a horrible poem. But it's better than the one with your plankeries and poems. Anyway, the point is, folks, she makes, you know, there's a lot of different faces.
Emily Dickinson, I'm how glad I am that you brought that.
So, okay.